Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Welcome to another edition of the Fundamental Health Podcast. I am so glad that you are here with me, and I am so excited about Nose to Tail November. This is our celebration of organ meats. It is our gratitude to the earth, to the animals that nourish us, and it is a true celebration, a true ceremony, a true hat tip to the benefits of Nose to Tail nutrition in our lives. Fresh organs, desiccated organs, all of it. You can check it out at heartandsoil.co. The hashtag is Nose to Tail November. If you need more nose to tail nutrition in your life, check us out at heartandsoil.co as well. We are making what I believe are the finest, the highest quality, grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised nose to tail organs, desiccated, encapsulated into gelatin capsules right here. Well, we're based in Austin, California, but these are from New Zealand animals on regenerative farms there. Right now, we've got Lifeblood, which is an amazing supplement with blood, whole blood. It's the only supplement with whole blood and spleen and liver. It's one of my favorites, and histamine and immune in stock. And believe me, there has been a lot of interest after the Rogan podcast. We are working our little nose to tails off to get beef organs back in stock. We've got Immuno Milk, which is a grass-fed, grass-finished colostrum coming back in the next few weeks, along with Heart of the Warrior. And many more supplements in the near future. So we were working really hard to get the supply chain stuff figured out. We know you guys depend on this, and we want to be able to supply you with this good stuff. Firestarter will be back very soon, probably next week. You can always check us out, heartandsoil.co. That is .co for the nose to tail nutrition. Thank you for being a part of the remembering. Including these organs is something that we are blessed with in our lives. They nourish us deeply, and they help us remember how humans are supposed to eat. And as you guys will all see, I'm also interested in how humans are supposed to live in all of the ways that make us alive and well and optimally healthy and fundamentally happy based on where we have come from. So heartandsoil.co, thank you guys. All right, on the podcast this week, I have none other than Nora Gidgaudas. She is the author of Primal Body, Primal Mind, and another book on the importance of eating fat in your diet. She is one of the paleo OGs. And speaking of how humans are supposed to live and the remembering, Nora thinks about this too. This podcast was recorded a few months ago, but it is still relevant. Nora spent a lot of time with wolves up in the Arctic. I talked to her about that. And we have some friendly debate about macro ratios with protein and fat. If you're interested in the first part of the sort of friendly debate series of is a carnivore diet or a carnivore-ish diet the real paleo diet, you can listen to the podcast I did with Lauren Cordain, the author of The Paleo Diet, and his crew, which is also at heartandsoil.co under the Learn tab. It's all there for you guys. But this is the second part of a little friendly debate amongst paleo people. And my position, my postulate, my premise is that a carnivore-ish diet is really the true paleo diet, that prioritizing meat and organs is the way that we should live, and the least toxic plant foods from time to time, which if you guys are following my work, you know is things like berries and non-sweet fruit, avocados, olives, squash. Those are the foods that our ancestors have eaten. Occasionally, they'll eat tubers if they can't get anything else, but as I talk about many times, when animal foods are available, especially animal foods eaten nose to tail, they will shun the tubers. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation with Nora Gidgaudas. Thanks for coming on to her. Also want to give a shout out to my other sponsors, White Oak Pastures, www.whiteoakpastures.com. These are the folks in Georgia making regeneratively raised meat and doing amazing things in the regenerative space in general. I love these guys. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD at White Oak Pastures for 10% off your first order. And they are making beef and lamb. They have organs. They're incredible. The farm is incredible in Bluffton, Georgia. This is how we regenerate the earth. All discussions of cows hurting the environment are based on faulty premises. When you see this type of agriculture, it is something I believe in so deeply. It is amazing. So check them out, whiteoakpastures.com. Also want to give a shout out to Chili Pad. You guys, 2020, crazy year. Like, that's an understatement. So much stress, which is going to affect your sleep. that affects your immunity, your general well-being. Quality sleep is when you rejuvenate your body and your mind. It affects glycogen stores, testosterone levels, inflammation, motor skills. I have found a huge improvement in my sleep when I use a cooling pad like the Chili Pad. I have the Uller, but it's made by Chili, and it's a mattress pad that goes on your body. It circulates on your bed, circulates cold water. You can go from 15 to 115, and it's just amazing. If you are sleeping on the ground in the earth, it is cool. The earth is a cooling mat. So you're creating a cooling mat. This is the remembering on your bed, and it makes my sleep so much better. In fact, it makes it really hard to travel because I always am too hot now when I sleep without a chilling pad. So I have the Uller. It's a climate control mattress topper. Water is so much more thermally efficient than air. The Uller has an app on your phone, smart scheduling, a warm awake feature. It'll waken you with a warm water and a UV light auto clean. You can also do a warmer part of the bed. You can do a full bed. So if you want to sleep cold, your partner wants to be warm, you can do that. This is the best time to do this. So this holiday season, Chili is helping us all with the gift of better sleep, which is so critical. Head over to Chili Technology, that is C-H-I-L-I, technology.com/carnivoreMD for the best deal of the season. They're offering it to listeners for a limited time. C-H-I-L-I, technology.com/carnivoreMD. You can use the code CarnivoreMD for 22% off a discount on Chili Pad, Uller, or the Chili Blanket. I love this thing. I love it. I also love Belcampo. You guys know this farm in Northern California, B-E-L-C-A-M-P-O. They are doing grass-fed, regeneratively raised, grass-finished organic meat and organs. Good people. I had Anya Fernald on the podcast. She is the chief cowgirl there. You can use the code CarnivoreMD for 20% off your order, or real soon they're going to be doing a 20% discount for Thanksgiving, and you can use the code CARNIVORE10 for an extra 10% off, which will get you 30% off at Belcampo. Their flat iron steaks are amazing. I love their suet. I love their liver. I love their ribeyes and their New York steaks. And their stew meat is an old standby. You can also get bones. They have all kinds of good stuff. Check them out at Belcampo. You guys know that regenerative agriculture is a piece of who I am. That's the soil in hardened soil. That's what we want to do. So I'm happy to support those farms with hardened soil, and I'm happy to support those farms with Belcampo and White Oak Pastures. These are good people. All right, guys, check them out, belcampo.com, CarnivoreMD, or Carnivore10. New sponsor this week, Cinder Grills. I've talked about them a little bit in the past if you guys get my newsletter at Heart and Soil. It's the world's only precision grill. This is like AI in a grill. It cooks your food to the exact temperature you set it to. It's the perfect steak machine. You guys have heard me talk a lot about polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, heterocyclic amines. One way to avoid those is by not burning your steak, making all the sear on the outside that's super black. You can sous vide it. Well, this is like a sous vide without the water. It's brilliant. You can cook a medium rare steak. You put it on the grill, you set it to 133 degrees, and you walk away. It'll cook it exactly 133. It'll let you know when your food is done, and it'll keep your food at that temperature. And then you can turn up the temperature for searing, put it back on for 45 seconds. It's perfect. It's impossible to overcook. It'll leave your temperature in your steak for 3 hours. You can even cook it from frozen solids straight out of the freezer. It's amazing. So check out Cinder, cindergrill.com. Fans of mine, you can get pre-orders. It's shipping in 4 weeks for the holidays. You can get use the code CarnivoreMD for $50 off and free shipping. Go to cindergrill.com/pages/CarnivoreMD. It might just be easier to put in the code CarnivoreMD when you check out at cindergrill.com, but check this thing out. This is a wizard. It is a wizarding engineering marvel, and it's really cool. I like to cook my steaks this way a lot because I don't like the plastic or the silicone in the sous vide. This is like sous vide without the plastic bags. It's amazing. Check it out, you guys. Love these guys. Cindergrill.com. Use the code CarnivoreMD. Last but not least, Blue Blocks. My goodness, how much appreciation for these guys helping us all avoid blue light. I went hunting this past weekend. I'm in the cabin. There are so many places where you just can't avoid blue light, and we want to live our lives. And I bring my blue blockers everywhere from Blue Blocks, B-L-U-B-L-O-X. They have Elton John lenses, which are the real nighttime lenses. They have the clear lenses, so I don't look like a hipster. I love them. People always say they like the way I look in glasses, so a lot of times they're Blue Blocks glasses, and they're blocking the blue light too. They've also got my favorite red light device now called the Hive, a little mini red light device. I'll use it at night, like a candle or like a little campfire. It's red light. I'll use it around my house. They've got bulbs for your house, which are red, and they have a sleep mask. They have all kinds of good stuff. Bluebox.com, BLUBLOX. Use the code CarnivoreMD for 15% off. All right, you guys, if you appreciate this podcast, please leave me a review on iTunes. This is how we reach more people. I'm going to give away a signed copy of my book to every month to somebody that leaves me a review on iTunes. Thank you for your support there. On to the podcast with Noriega Gowdes. Listen after for what is going on with me. Nora, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, Paul, thanks for having me. This has been a long time coming, and I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, we've been kind of crossing ships in the night, and I'm glad we finally were able to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's taken a little bit, but I'm glad we were able to finally get this to work out.
We got it figured out. You know, when I was in medical school, I remember reading a lot of your stuff. I was influenced by your stuff for many years and have always really appreciated it. So thank you for all of your work. Your first book was Primal Body, Primal Mind. We'll probably talk about a lot of those ideas in the podcast today.
Sure.
As many listening to this podcast will know, you know, my roots are really in paleo, and I think that's where I've you know, kind of orbited for a long time, and carnivore has been, you know, a suborbit of paleo, and maybe carnivore is a subset of paleo in some ways. But I think that this is the community which I originally found a home. So that's pretty cool. So tell us a little bit about your story and how you came to paleo or these ideas, because it's pretty interesting how you got here.
Yeah, you know, it's a long, convoluted trail. I mean, my interest in nutrition goes back more than 35, you know, years. My focus on that being a passion of mine, a first love, if you will. Mm-hmm. Then I spent more than 20 years working in clinical practice, doing something called neurofeedback, working with the brain, and also incorporating a lot of these principles that I write about, you know, with the clinical populations I worked with, and usually got my best results when I combined those two modalities. And so, but, you know, prior to about 1991, I was, you know, I was interested in nutrition, but my early interest in nutrition was sort of sparked by an interest in supplements and the early, you know, biohacking didn't originate, you know, with the kind of the current trend. It originated with people like Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw and whatever else back in the 80s. And I was really into that. And I was into, you know, like amino acid therapy for improving mood and all that kind of stuff. But I was bought into, I didn't really have a foundational substrate upon which to build any kind of a theoretical model of what kind of diet was best. I was, you know, there was a lot of promotion even back then of sort of vegetarian and vegan approaches being healthier, and the low fat paradigm sort of ruled the roost, if you will. Right. And I was kind of bought into that. And, you know, without really having, you know, I didn't think I had much reason to question it. And then I had an opportunity to travel to the high Arctic. And I spent a whole summer of my life living less than 500 miles from the North Pole with a family of wild wolves in the company of a wolf biologist by the name of Dr. L. David Meach. And he filmed a National Geographic documentary up there called White Wolf, which is still, you know, I think you could probably still find, you know, DVDs of that or whatever out there. I don't know if it's on YouTube or anything, but that was the family of wolves I was with. And that was the biologist I was with. It was just him and me that summer and fairly industrial strength religious experience. But anyway, I was assisting in behavioral research, and we just lived with this family of wolves, and we observed what they did, and we followed them on their hunts. And anyway, there was an Inuit community that we spent a few days or a day or two anyway, prior to heading up there. And then I also spent another day or two coming back. I mean, there's no direct flight to this area, you know? And so it was like taking planes to different locations and then finally just sort of hitching a ride on a cargo plane, which was a Twin Otter, for the last leg to this particular area. But anyway, there was a little village called Resolute Bay, and in the Queen Elizabeth High Arctic Archipelago, and there were about 200 Inuit living there. And it's, you know, it's basically permafrost and frost-shattered shale and not a whole lot of anything growing. And what you had was a community of Inuit people that was probably leading about an 80% subsistence lifestyle at that point. I think that's changed a lot now, because and to the detriment of everybody living there. But at the time, they were probably getting most of their food from the surrounding waters, from hunting muskoxen, caribou, and, you know, walrus and, you know, whale and whatever else. Anyway, I was sort of gobsmacked by the fact that, you know, there's nothing growing. I mean, I remember going up there thinking, how am I going to make it through this summer, you know, without any fresh vegetables, without salads, you know, without being able to juice or whatever else? Because I thought that was the cornerstone for health. That had to be the cornerstone for health. And when I got up there, I realized that not only did I not have access to that, but the indigenous people living in that area for the last 10,000 years didn't have access to that. And we're talking high Arctic. There are, you know, lower Arctic regions where maybe you get some berries in the summer and things like that. But really in this area, you know, there really weren't any berries growing that anybody could forage upon. It was really a total reliance upon meat, and especially the fat of the animals that these people hunted for thousands and thousands of years. And I thought, how can they possibly be healthy eating a diet like that? And there were, you know, dead seals laying in people's front yards. That was their refrigeration because it was, you know, it was really cold. And I'm just sitting there thinking about that, and it just niggled at me. It really bugged me. I wasn't seeing overweight people. People seemed pretty happy. The kids were really happy and healthy and rosy-cheeked and curious and, you know, just awesome, bright kids. And I'm thinking, how can they do this without vegetables? And, you know, there was a grocery store there in Resolute that was about the size of the building I'm sitting in, like about this big, you know.
Tiny. People may not be able to see on iTunes, but it's a small building.
Well, it was the post office. It was a couple of other things, right, too, you know. And once every couple of weeks, a Twin Otter would fly in and dump off some limp vegetables and then a bunch of non-perishable crap, you know, processed crap. And people there liked that, the processed crap, because it was tasty, but it was expensive. And so it was impractical as any kind of major means of, you know, feeding your family. They mostly hunted because it was, and fished because that's what was practical. But when I got to Ellesmere, which was quite a bit more beautiful than Resolute, and it was just amazingly pristine, I realized that I was looking at a landscape that was probably not unlike Northern Europe at the end of the last ice age, you know, when Cro-Magnon humans or 40,000 years ago, where Cro-Magnon came across, and, you know, again, the ground was frozen. There wasn't a whole lot to eat, but there were quite a few signs and archaeological sites that had never been touched by archaeologists, you know, the ancient sites. In other words, they weren't archaeological sites. They were ancient sites where, there you could see where there had been dwellings and villages and things like that of people living. And what you saw were cracked open skulls everywhere and cracked open bones, long bones, you know, where marrow had been extracted for food. Not a lot of signs of, you know, fishing, some whale bones. I found quite a few whale bones and things like that around, especially on the edges of the shore. And then when you went further inland, there were other cultures that were there much longer ago, and where it was exclusively land mammal based, you know, detritus that you saw sort of strewn about. And I found myself just not really knowing what to do with all of that. And then on top of everything, I began developing cravings for fat in ways I just didn't even know what to do with, other than just start eating a lot of fat. You know, we had butter with us, you know, we had nut butters, you know, we had salami and cheese. I mean, not necessarily the best quality fats. We did some hunting for our food, but, you know, we weren't hunting large animals. We were mainly hunting Arctic hare, and those were relatively lean animals, but we, you know, were like throwing gobs of butter in the pan as we cooked up the meat and whatever else. And I didn't move very much that summer. I was very well bundled against the cold. We mostly sat and watched wolves do what they did around the den, or we rode on four-wheelers. There wasn't a lot of exercise to be had. And so I sat on my butt, ate a lot of fat, and by the end of the summer, I'd lost about 25 pounds. And, you know, when I got off the plane and hugged my best friend who came to pick me up, they looked at me and they said, did you do this on purpose? Because I'd lost all this weight. I was super lean, you know. And mind you, I understand that there is, you know, there's a thermogenic thing at work. But the fact is that, you know, I was very well bundled against the cold. And you would think by eating all this fat-rich food that I would have packed on some pounds because I really wasn't exercising. So there was something there for me to reckon with. And I really didn't know what to do with it until I stumbled across Weston Price's work. And then I thought, of course, you know, this makes sense to look at things from this sort of anthropologic perspective. And, but, you know, in my mind, his work didn't go back far enough, right? Because I understood that the world was a very different place prior to the Holocene, prior to a lot of the indigenous cultures that he studied. And I really wanted to go back and understand what the earliest selective pressures were and what the dietary, you know, availability of various things would have been that might have shaped us physiologically and might have shaped our nutritional requirements. And so I think that's why I chose the word primal in my whole thing. You know, there are lots of people using the word primal. I was probably the first in the genre to use it. But to me, it just meant, I don't think it means a whole lot that's very different from paleo, other than to me, it implied something older, something that went back a lot further, because a lot of so-called, you know, paleo diet studies were really based upon much more recent Neolithic cultures. And I really wanted to go back a lot further. And what I found was a lot of evidence that, fat to us as an evolving species really would have equated with survival. And it made a lot of sense to me that, you know, fat being extremely energy dense and nutrient dense and whatever else, that, of course, that's something we would have gravitated to. And we were unique among primates in the fact that we did that. And it's not just about energy, right? It's about the nutrient density that comes with, you know, the fat-soluble nutrients, the essential fatty acids, and all of the nutrient elements that come into play with a fat-rich diet when you're eating the fat of an animal that, of course, was naturally allowed to consume what was, you know, proper for it to consume, right? And that's, you know, therein lies the rub, you know, in terms of our modern day deal, you know, when vegetarians and vegans are screaming about, you know, the unhealthy nature of feedlot meats, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with them. Although I guess the recent red meat study disagrees with them, but I digress. but I still, you know, I think that there's ample reason to be very uncompromising in our dietary choices in that regard. So that led me into this kind of ancestral perspective. I wrote the book Primal Body, Primal Mind. But what I realized along the way too was that even though to me, you know, taking a close look at what would have been natural for our most ancient, you know, evolutionary ancestors to consume, to me, that is the only rational starting place in terms of determining what is optimal for us now. But it's not an endpoint for me. It's a useful starting place, but we have to consider the fact that our prehistoric ancestors weren't necessarily selecting food based on what was going to help them live longest and healthiest. There were certain foods that they habitually consumed, and that is highly significant to me, and we have to accept that as some sort of foundational consideration. But in my mind, just because something grew out of the ground, you know, and they were able to shove something in their face and chew it up and swallow it and not drop dead, isn't necessarily an indication that that food was optimal for them any more than it would be optimal for us today, right? And then I had to ask myself, well, how would I know what was optimal and what wasn't? And that's where I incorporated aspects of longevity research into my studies, and found a way of sort of cross-pollinating, if you will, those ancestral concepts with what we now understand in terms of longevity research in order to better optimize those prehistoric principles for the, you know, for modern health, but also I wanted to take into account the uniquely toxic environment that we live in today. I think what we're doing today is living in a far more toxic and challenging and dangerous environment than anything our prehistoric ancestors could have wrapped themselves around, right?
It's kind of scary.
It goes beyond being scary. Yeah. I mean, it's something, I mean, I could be a total buzzkill at parties, you know, going on.
Well, we should talk about that too. We should talk about that too. Can we unpack a little bit about that story? That's amazing. Like just hearing that, I'm thinking there are so many pieces of that I think are so fascinating. Let's just start with the wolves. Like you lived with wolves. Like,
yeah. Some people wonder if I wasn't raised by them, you know.
So you were in a.
I wonder, but yeah.
You were in a tent or a cabin, like you guys were just.
A lot of the time, I was just laying out on the tundra. I mean, they would come by and they would like sniff my hair when I was sleeping. I'd see huge prints in the sand right behind my head, you know, where I was sleeping. Well, I had a tent as well, you know, particularly whether it was inclement weather or whatever. Could go into the tent and you know put a little eye shades on, but it was 24-hour sunlight. And so it messed with your circadian rhythms a lot, you know, it was a really interesting thing. But my sleep habits, you know, sometimes I was just sleeping out on the tundra, you know, or other times, you know, we'd use a tent. We had a camp where we had a couple of tents and we actually dug down into the permafrost and created a cache where we put fresh meat and so we brought some onions along and a couple of carrots, things that were going to be a little bit slow to perish that we could add, you know, to our stir fries and things. But, you know, that stuff by the end of the summer, you know, we were out of all that. But
so by the end of the summer, you were eating a carnivore diet.
Well, no, I wasn't actually. We had we had some of, boiling bag types of, stuff and, and we had some different things. We hunted some, but
so the wolves were friendly. They didn't, I mean, people think of wolves.
They treated us with either curiosity or indifference. And wow. I found that fascinating because, you know, and I still, that niggles at me to this day because really everything in their environment is one of two things, predator or prey.
Right.
Had I been seen as either, I wouldn't be here.
Right.
Had I been seen as a wolf, I wouldn't be here. You know, because in fact, we watched then there was a trespassing wolf that summer that came into the territory and they ripped her to shreds.
Really?
And, the foxes and, you know, whatever were terrified of the wolves. I mean, they will go and they will kill off other predators or chase them off in the environment. Even the polar bears are afraid of the wolves. They will chase them off, harass them and chase them off. And obviously prey is prey. And we weren't any of those things to them. I don't know what we were, but they seemed to have an acceptance of our presence. Sometimes they were curious and came by and checked us out a little bit. I never once felt threatened. I mean, I respected the formidability of their, I mean, these are, man, I mean, especially the alpha female who we cleverly named Whitey, all the wolves were white, but she was a formidable predator and I wouldn't have wanted to mess with her on a bad day, but no. she was the mother of the pups and whatever, they were, in fact, there were occasions where I remember, you know, the first time this happened, the pups came out of the den area and they saw us sitting there, and you know, we typically stayed fairly still. They didn't like it when we got up and moved around. That made them nervous. So we sat there, you know, and just observed them near the den. And the pups came bounding over. They were really excited to see us sitting there. And they were like tugging at our bootlaces. And it was a strictly hands-off deal. As tempting as it was to just scoop them up and give them a smooch, you know, it's like, no, mom would have ripped our lips off. So,
right. Did you observe them hunting? Did you see the wolves hunt?
Yeah, and I have an interesting thing to say about that, but just really quick, one of the things that would happen is that I remember Whitey looking at us and kind of, you know, and looking at the pups near us, and she just kind of went and turned around and went hunting for a couple of days and left us to babysit the pups. And it's like, what the hell's going through her mind? What are we to them? they clearly trusted us. We gave them no reason to not trust us. They must have seen us as intelligent and capable enough to watch out for their young, and benign enough to watch out for the young. But I never really fully grasped how they perceived us. They didn't greet us the way they would have greeted PAC members. They didn't. Anyway, it was weird. So in terms of hunting, you know, one of the things that is very interesting to note about the hunting habits of wolves versus the hunting habits of ancient humans, when it comes to wild carnivores, like wolves, and this is, you know, true of really most hunting carnivores, they tend to preferentially, or not preferentially, but they tend to go after the old, the sick, the weak, the very young, in their, you know, in their hunting habits, not because that's what they prefer necessarily, but it's because they're opportunistic and that's what's easiest for them to catch. Mm-hmm. You know, with the limited technology they had, despite, you know, a high degree of intelligence and cooperative hunting ability, they would, you know, they would typically go after those kinds of animals. And I'm sure they would have loved to, you know, sink their jaws into a nice, fat, sassy, healthy young animal, you know, in its prime. But that isn't what they went after. They knew not to bother with that. Human hunters, on the other hand, preferentially went after the fat, sassy animals, even though they were harder to catch and quite a bit more dangerous to go after, because they knew there was a big payoff.
They wanted the fat.
Worth it to them. They wanted the fat.
I've seen in the anthropologic literature that all sorts of tribes did that. They always hunted the fattest animals, and if the animals were too lean, they just didn't even hunt them.
That's right. Or they'd just leave them out in the sun to rot and move on to the something that was had more right. fat, because they understood that protein without sufficient fat was detrimental, right? That there was a protein ceiling. They may not have understood that concept, but they did know that eating too much lean meat could make you sick. And they knew that fat was really, really, really important. And this wasn't just true in the Arctic. This was true in places like the Aboriginal outback and, you know, and in tropical places, where fat has always been, you know, significantly sought after, you know, as a critical, you know, thing. And of course, you know, Weston Price, there were two things that, so lots of people that, and, you know, I'm on the board of, as I guess you know, because we ran into each other at AHS and I was working the Price Pottinger booth. I'm on the board of the Price Pottinger Nutrition Foundation. There are 67. That's not the same thing as the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Right. Different.
The Sally Fallon Foundation. It's you know, this is a 67-year-old organization that owns the entire repository of Weston Price's work, of Francis Pottinger's work, and the work of like 16 other nutritional pioneers. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Price, of course, looked at the diets of all these what he called primitive people groups all over the world. He traveled 100,000 miles over 10 years. And what he found was a distinct lack of disease and, you know, extraordinary health and robustness and great teeth and great skeletal structure and great mental health and all this stuff. And of course the diets varied quite a bit from place to place. And so many people that are familiar with his work, including many people promoting his work, kind of their takeaway was just eat real food, right? But that's not even necessarily what Weston Price himself concluded. Or at the very least, he asked himself a very highly intelligent question, because he was a highly intelligent guy. He said, what did all of these cultures where I saw optimal health, what did they all have in common, right? There were two things. Number one, there weren't any vegetarian or vegan cultures. They all consumed as great a variety of animal source foods as were available to them. Everyone. He looked for a vegan culture. He tried to find one. He couldn't find one. He was disappointed. But the second thing, and the thing that kind of gobsmacked me, was that in every single instance where there was, in his view, optimal health, the most important food, the most venerated food, the most sought after food, the most sacred food were those foods that were highest in fat, animal fat, and fat soluble nutrients. And to me, what you have with those two things is certainly the foundational scaffolding, if you will, for the health of literally every single human alive. You know, the idea that everybody's different. You want to see me start tearing my hair out of my head and get me riled up really fast. It's politics. It's nutritional politics. But that isn't, you know, it isn't true. I mean, yes, there is bioindividuality. But the fact of the matter is, as a species, we are much more alike than unalike. In fact,
I couldn't agree with you more.
What defines us as a species isn't our differences. It's those things that we share in common. And right. Okay, so we all have unique fingerprints. But guess what? We all have fingers.
Hey.
And so because we all have the same organs and same types of tissues and the, same type anyway of enlarged brain, some work better than others, but I'm not going to name names. and, you know, we have blood pH of between 7.35 and 7.45 of necessity. And we all have a hydrochloric acid-based digestive system, not a fermentative one, as enjoyed by herbivores, you know, as required by herbivores. And as such, we're designed to get most of our nutrition from animals that have synthesized the nutrients we require for us, which is far more efficient, obviously. And it also allowed for a much greater variety of types of fat that make up our tissues, that make up our brain structure. And the single most distinguishing characteristic of the human species, of course, is our unusually large brains that grew encephalized in an unprecedented fashion throughout the course of our evolutionary history. It just grew so rapidly. And when you look at the types of fatty acids that that represent our unique human cognition, the two that stand out are these 20 and 22 carbon fats, arachidonic acid and docosahexaenoic acid, both of which are found exclusively within the fat of animals. That is a very, very unique characteristic. The primary, fatty acid, responsible for our unique human cognition, of course, DHA, which is this extraordinary substance, extraordinary molecule. It actually, we have an omega-3 based cognition. And even our closest primate relatives have an omega-6 based cognition, you know. And so we kind of, in fact, the size of our gut, is so much smaller than even our closest primate relatives. And by the way, all the great apes hunted meat and to some degree.
Yes, they did, yeah.
Meat, with the exception of herbivorous gorillas, which, by the way, have a brain only about a third of the size that would be expected of a primate their size. But a chimp, which is supposed to be our closest relative, they have a gut size of about 52% of its digestive tract. So they have a primarily fermentative-based digestive system with some ability to digest and assimilate meat. But ours is only about 20%. And it's less than only about half of what should be expected for a primate of our size. And yet we have a longer small intestine, a much shorter large intestine, and we rely on hydrochloric acid. And we need that, not just for digesting protein, but for establishing the signaling that occurs further south down the pike in our digestive tract. We have large gallbladders, obviously. But that hydrochloric acid is also essential for the ionization and absorption and utilization of minerals in our diets. And, we are very, very unique primate species in that regard.
So uniquely adapted to eating animals.
We are uniquely adapted to eating animals. There's no question for that. Now, the question becomes, we know from the stable isotopic research happening at the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and all of that, our prehistoric ancestors weren't just carnivores. They were very high-level carnivores in excess even of many of the other carnivorous animals that we co-evolved with. Does that mean, though, that we need to consume as much of meat today as they did? And is that optimal for us? And, you know, my answer to that is no, mm-hmm. that we're much better off moderating our protein intake for a variety of reasons. And again, of necessity, we have to have animal source protein. We have foundational requirements for this. We are evolutionarily and genetically adapted to a diet that consists of a variety of animal source foods. But in my belief, and you know, relative certainly to what I've discovered along the way, and I think there's quite a bit of research to corroborate, that fat was meant to be of necessity, dominate in our caloric intake and fat-soluble nutrients in our nutritional intake. And I think we're better off if we moderate the protein intake to just what we need, as long as our digestive process is working well. And if it isn't, more protein isn't better, the way a lot of recommendations, there are a lot of people that recommend higher protein as we age because people aren't digesting it as well. To me, you just end up with more rotting protein in your gut. You know, the focus really should be on improving digestion instead of increasing protein. So I take a little bit of issue with the carnivore diet, at least some renditions of it that suggest, you know, as much meat as you want, more is better. It's all great.
Did you hear the talk that I gave at AHS?
No.
Do you know what it was about?
No.
It was about fat.
Well, good for you.
Man. It was about animal fat, and it was about animal fat as the most precious human nutrient. So that's what, it's funny how serendipitous. Yeah. So that was the talk that I gave. That was the talk that I gave at the Ancestral Health Symposium, and people can listen to that talk. That talk is published. I think that talk is on my YouTube channel if people want to see it, but I talked about many of the same themes that you're talking about, the sacredness of fat in cultures throughout the world, throughout human history, the seeking of fat. And, you know, I think that what's interesting about those stable isotope studies, I don't think that they're saying that humans ate a lot of protein. I think what they're good at distinguishing is where we got our protein from.
Right.
Because they're showing us that we got our protein from animals rather than plants.
Right.
And because of the nitrogen and the carbon isotopes. And so that, I think, is quite unique about it. And that's been the part that I've taken away from them. I don't think we know what the macros of our ancestors were because we don't have a sense of where the fat was coming from. But because of the way that nitrogen and carbon bioaccumulate as you go up the trophic food chain, we can see that our protein was coming from animals rather than plants. So for me, I've always kind of said, hey, here is evidence that we were primarily carnivores. But I think, as you've suggested, and as Miki Bendor has suggested, and many others have suggested, that we were hunting the fattiest animals, and who knows what macros we were getting. And I think we're still trying to figure out where the protein to fat macro is. And I would tend to agree with you that overconsumption of protein is probably not a great thing. The question becomes, and we can probably talk about this a little bit, how much, what's the sweet spot for protein? I'd be curious to hear what you think about that.
Sure. Well, I do want to cite a little bit of, so sometimes when you don't have clear data, like you say, in terms of macros, et cetera, we can extrapolate a little bit from logic. When we look at the world that we occupied prior to the end of this last ice age, which I say the end, we're still in it. We just have been in a period of glacial retreat as opposed to glacial advance. But we're still in the quaternary. But at any rate.
Well, help us talk about those dates a little bit, because earlier you mentioned the Holocene and the Neolithic Revolution. I want to make sure people know what we're talking about here, because the Neolithic Revolutions,
somewhere between 12,800 years ago and 11,600 years ago, there were some huge upheavals that occurred.
Right.
And the current, the current thinking about this is that, you know, there was a catastrophic, mass extinction event that rivaled that of the dinosaurs at that time. Prior to that time period, and of course, you know, there were 11,800, they think there was a comet that hit that set up the conditions for the Younger Dryas, which was another plunge into cold. And then bam, something else happened about 11,600 years ago to throw us out of that, caused sea levels to rise about 400 feet, and, you know, literally wiped out 120 additional species of megafauna we used to share this planet with.
Right. So big
massive
animals.
Herbivores, right? You know, woolly mammoths, mastodons, giant sloths, you know, Irish elk, giant aurochs, you know, all kinds of things. You can go on and on and on. There were tens of millions of these animals. And we hunted them. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest we consumed quite a lot of that, in fact. And there's a lot of evidence, too, to suggest that, you know, Homo erectus was eating elephants in Africa and all of that, you know, right. as a wonderful food package. And the thing is that if you extrapolate from the body fat of elephants, they estimate woolly mammoths had body fat of, you know, probably more than 50%. And then, of course, you're talking about the marrow and the tongue and the brain and all of the 4 inches of subcutaneous fat under the hide that we would have gobbled up along with everything else.
So tons of fat on these megafauna.
Tons of fat and tons of meat, which is part of why I think we were considered such high-level carnivores. You take down one woolly mammoth, right, and you've got a family barbecue that's going to last a good week, you know?
Or more.
And so
generally, as animals get bigger, they tend to get fattier.
They get fattier.
And so most of the animals
after the biggest animals we could hunt.
Yes.
And even in the Mediterranean regions, where one might assume that, well, there was so much easily gotten seafood, we had to have, you know, really gone to that. And Mesolithic hunters back then, you know, were still going after the biggest animals, biggest terrestrial herbivores that they could hunt. They were not going preferentially after seafood. This whole idea that, you know, you don't see too many cave paintings of fish, you know? But what you do see, and this is something that I've also been gobsmacked by, when, you know, because I love cave art. I just love it. To me, it's some of the most beautiful artwork humans have ever created. And so I was going through, and back when I was still using Google, which I don't anymore, but I was imaging, you know, that's a whole other talk. You know, going and looking at all of these different cave paintings. And what I suddenly realized was, you know, I mean, these human artists were extraordinary artists. I mean, when you look at the way, for instance, in Chovy Cave, when they painted cave lions, they were perfectly proportioned, muscular animals, you know, and they were very accurate in their depiction. But, you know, or other predators. But when they depicted the animals they actually hunted, what did you see? You saw something that looked like it came off a Macy's Day Parade float, this great big bubble of a body and tiny little stick legs, this disproportionately fat body. And I think what they were doing was, you know, because these paintings are now understood to be largely shamanic in nature, they were probably, you know, it was maybe like a prehistoric vision board or something like that, you know, depicting what they most sought after in the animals that they hunted. Fat and sassy,
yep. The fattest of the animals. Because as you suggest, I think that there is clearly a physiologic threshold for protein.
Yes.
And there's a physiologic ceiling. And if we exceed that, we're probably taxing our bodies in a negative way. Now, I think that the other end of the spectrum is you can go too low on like a ketogenic diet or something. So what do you think of as like a sweet spot for protein for humans? Maybe we can compare our perspectives.
Right. So what we know is that that during the period of our development where we need, you know, of course, I wrote a lot about mTOR, right? So this all kind of boils down to mTOR in my mind. And in my view, that's something that we really kind of want to keep at the end of a short leash. We don't want to be activating this metabolic pathway too much.
Too much, because we need it sometimes, right?
During periods, if we need periods of cellular proliferation and growth, okay. So as babies, if you're pregnant or trying to become pregnant, you're a baby, a child, a teen, an infant, you're going to need more protein. Now, the time period in our lives where we would maybe require the most rapid cellular proliferation, I think we'd all agree would be infancy, right? Well, the amount of protein in mother's milk is about a gram per kilogram. I mean, the intake of, or not a gram per kilo, a gram per 100 grams or so protein content. Infants have been there was a study that looked at how much protein do infants actually get. And they found that it's roughly a gram per kilogram of body weight. Mm-hmm. Now that's during the time period in our lives where we need the most rapid cell growth, the most rapid cellular division. And to me, that's more than we need as an adult. And we know that anything over about 21 grams of protein in a meal or so, 21, 25 at most, is going to activate that mTOR pathway, which stimulates rapid cell division, cellular proliferation. Now, again, if you're growing, you know, baby, child, teen, pregnant woman, trying to become pregnant, whatever, okay. Or maybe you're an elite athlete that, you know, is just, you know, driving your body into the ground and you need, you know, to replenish your protein stores in a more, you know, aggressive fashion than you might otherwise. Okay, add 25, you know, percent maybe onto my basic recommendations. But the fact of the matter is that the majority of us, if we're not reproducing or planning to reproduce anytime soon, in my view, what we want to do is maintain a protein ceiling of maybe no more than about 8 grams per kilogram of what I call estimated ideal body weight. You know, a lot of people use the term lean tissue mass, but who the hell is going to go out and get their lean tissue mass calculated, right? Some people will. Most people won't. So what I tell people is that, well, if you knew you were smoking hot in high school when you weighed 130 and you were really lean and, you know, and whatever, well, then shoot for that. Weight. It's crude. It's not precise. It's not going to be precise. But that's really the ballpark that I end up recommending. Now, if you're somebody that either has cancer or you're at high risk for cancer, I would drop that down to maybe 0.5, 0.6 gram per kilogram of estimated ideal body weight. Because one thing you do not want to do, if you're wanting to keep cancer at, you know, at bay or address it, as something happening in your body, you do not want to overconsume protein. And anything over about 21 grams is going to activate that mTOR pathway. And so I advise people to try to keep the amount of protein you consume in a meal below about that amount, the actual protein. And obviously that's about 7 grams of protein and meat or fish and 6 to 8 grams in an egg and, you know, kind of go according to that. And again, it's only too little an amount. I mean, the thing is to strive for protein adequacy to meet those requirements, but not exceed them, except under certain specific circumstances, you know, and that's because there are far too many detriments associated with mTOR activation. And particularly now that cancer, just there was a thing the other day that just said cancer just became the number one cause of mortality.
I think, yeah. Can I add some thoughts?
Sure,
there?
Go ahead. Yeah,
I think I see things a little bit differently. I've always kind of seen it as we want to activate throughout our life. I think we want to activate mTOR throughout our life. I think we want to have mTOR on at certain times of the day. I don't think we ever want zero mTOR activation. And I get a little worried about trying to completely abrogate mTOR signaling, because I think we want to maintain lean muscle mass. We want to maintain bone density. I think that we are continually recycling and repairing our body, and that it's okay to have mTOR turned on throughout our life. The signals that turn mTOR on are complex. It's more than just leucine. It's more than protein. It's also exercise. And so to say, I think that I get a little worried about
either, but yeah.
Well, we could talk about that. Yeah. I get a little worried about, you know, too much concern about mTOR, because exercise turns on mTOR, and I think exercise is a healthy thing, but we can talk about your views on that if you disagree. And then insulin also turns on mTOR. And there are studies that I've talked about a lot that in cell culture, and of course the relative effects of leucine and or protein, but leucine is the main amino acid in protein that's going to trigger mTOR complex 1 or mTORC1, right? Their differential effects of mTOR on mTOR by leucine and insulin in the muscle versus the liver. And so it's a little bit of a complex equation, but overall, at least in cell culture, in human myotubes, which I think are probably reflective of muscle, insulin is a bigger trigger for mTOR than leucine is. It turns it on for a longer amount of time, and more robustly. And
well, I think we don't want much insulin either, right? I mean, about restricting insulin. I mean, nobody's going to eliminate it completely, and nor, you know, it's obviously an important signaling molecule. Its primary biological purpose is about the coordination of our energy stores with reproduction and lifespan. I mean, both mTOR and insulin are basically related to reproductive pathways. But the thing is that when you do restrict mTOR, what you are doing instead of making new cells, which is an expensive thing to do and a potentially risky thing to do, particularly in the modern world in which we live, where we're surrounded by so many, you know, toxic mutagenic influences, that what we want to do when you restrict mTOR, what you're actually upregulating instead is maintenance and repair. And it's I like to put it in modern day economic terms, that, you know, it's like sending a message, you know, to your body that, well, it's too expensive to build a new house right now, so let's fix up the one we've got. And you can actually do a lot to retain lean tissue mass, because you're not going to be using as much amino acid for the creation of more blood sugar and all that kind of a thing. You're more likely to retain the lean tissue mass you've got if you're doing that. You may not be making lots more, but why do you need to make lots more, right? As long as you're able to maintain what you have. This has shown up in like every, you know, all the major anti-aging studies do imply that mTOR, you know, minimizing the activation of mTOR is a much smarter thing to do than activating it. And I know we differ in this, but there's this, you know, almost every cancerous process has upregulated mTOR as part of that process. That growth factors are the impetus for cancer metastasis and cancer growth. And that's actually, mTOR is involved in all of that, as is insulin, as is leptin, as is IGF-1, which is also upregulated through mTOR. All of these things have powerful, basically metastatic effects.
I get a little bit scared about equating mTOR directly with cancer. I just don't think it's quite that simple.
But it's in the literature. I mean,
yeah, but it's not
really
that simple. It's really not as simple as you eat extra protein, you get cancer. That's an overly simplified equation.
It's not that mTOR gives you cancer. Is that it provides an impetus for a mutated cell to proliferate. That's the issue.
Yeah, I think it's the cancer literature is quite complicated, and I think it's a little more complex than just overactivation of mTOR. And I think that there are many people who eat, you know, who activate mTOR a lot and do not get cancer. I think the initial inciting events of cancer are more complex than this. And to suggest limiting the protein that strictly, I fear, will lead to sarcopenia, will lead to bone mineral loss, will lead to problems. And I think it's possible.
That's only if your digestion is off, though, really. If you're getting adequate amounts, you're meeting your protein requirements, you're just not exceeding them. That's the idea.
Well, I fear also that I think that people have actually taken the autophagy thing a little too far. I was talking to Rob Wolf about this on a previous podcast. I don't think that we always want to be mTOR off. I don't think we always want AMP kinase on. This is obviously an oversimplification. I don't think we always want to be doing cellular house cleaning. We don't always want to be repairing the house. We don't always want to be tearing it down. Sometimes we need to be building it up. It's okay to have anabolic signals from time to time. I think that if we do too much, we know that if we just break down, we're eventually going to get to a problem. This is sort of the idea, you know, of the Hayflick limit and these ideas around, I think you can overdo autophagy. And my perspective, at least now, is that we can easily have a balance of these, right? That even on a daily basis, if we're not over-triggering insulin, if we're not insulin resistant and having high levels of basal insulin, we're going to have times in the day when mTOR is off and times in the day where mTOR is on, mm-hmm. right? So even if we do time-restricted feeding for 6 hours and mTOR is on, and especially if we're using leucine as a trigger, obviously, again, this is clearly an oversimplification, but if we're using a precise trigger like a protein rather than a carbohydrate or an insulin signal for insulin, you could have a period of 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day where mTOR is on And then, you know, a huge part of the day, 18 hours, 16 hours, where it's essentially off, because there's a large part of my day where I don't do anything but water. So during that period, it's off, right? It's kind of like a light switch. I can flip it on and off, but I have to turn it on sometimes. I don't think we should really fear turning it on. I think the problem arises with the Western diet where it's always on. And people in eating a Western diet were never getting autophagy because people are only, they're eating, you know, 16 hours a day, or they're eating 20 hours a day, or, you know, they're eating all the time, or they're having an insulin signal for the entire day. They don't get any of this cellular recycling. But I think that to compress it that much, or to completely get rid of it, I worry about this.
Well, nobody's going to completely get rid of it, but my argument is for keeping it at a minimum, doing what we can to minimize it. Look, yeah, most of the people I know doing really well on the carnivore diet are younger people. You know, when you hit middle age, you're going to run a higher risk of triggering, you know, oncogenic process or triggering metastatic processes if something happens to mutate into cancer in your body. You know, Atkins got really, really lousy results, you know, trying to treat cancer. And we know that carnivores in the wild, frankly, they're not long-lived animals by and large. Mm-hmm. And so the idea to me is to, you know, do what we can to minimize those things that it, particularly in the modern world in which we live, that is so much more challenging in terms of toxicity, in terms of, you know, mutagenic substances that are in our air, water, and food supply, you know, radiation contamination, EMF everywhere, all kinds of things are potential triggers for cancer now, which again is now the leading cause of mortality. So in my mind, anything that minimizes the potential for that metastatic, you know, process, anything that minimizes the potential for cellular proliferation is probably a smarter thing, particularly as we age, as we move past middle age, it becomes smarter and smarter thing to do. But what's really important is that whatever protein you are consuming, that you are digesting it well and assimilating it well. And that means putting a very strong focus on, you know, making sure that your digestive processes, you know, are healthy and robust, or that you're supplementing with hydrochloric acid or enzymes or whatever in a way that allow you to make the best possible use, the most thorough use of the protein you actually consume.
What is up, you guys? Nora and I are talking a ton about the importance of nose-to-tail nutrition in this podcast. Just wanted to take a moment out from the podcast to remind you guys about Heart and Soil, heartandsoil.co. If you can't get the fresh organs or you don't want to eat fresh organs, as both Nora and I clearly agree in this podcast, it's super important to get nose-to-tail nutrition, to get the unique nutrients in organ foods, and that's where desiccated organs come in. Check us out, heartandsoil.co. If you need more nose-to-tail nutrition in your life, we are making the finest desiccated organs encapsulated conveniently in amazing Austin, Texas, from grass-fed, grass-finished animals raised regeneratively in New Zealand. So check us out if you need desiccated organs in your life. Back to the podcast. That's actually another interesting point. I think that if we don't consume protein or we don't consume animal meat, we're at an increased risk of having problems with digestion due to zinc deficiency.
We are. You don't use it, you're going to lose it.
Yeah, you'll lose the digestion. And so many times you'll hear about people who don't eat meat and their digestion goes to pot. You know, their digestion gets bad because of zinc deficiency or other cofactors or choline deficiency, causing a bile acid, inadequacy in the bile. And so I think that there's so many valuable things in animal meat. I think if we underconsume this, we could run into real digestive problems as well.
Well, it's not animal meat that, you know, again, my emphasis is on animal fats, you know, in terms of our primary nutritional whatever things. I think that
there
are a lot of really critical nutrients in the meat of animals, but
there's no zinc, right? There's no zinc in animal fat. I think that animal fat.
No, true. That's true. Yeah. And again, I'm not opposed to eating meat.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, organ meats and things like liver, you know, we don't talk enough about those things. It's all about chicken and steak and, you know, fish fillets and things like that. And really, You know, we have a lot of taboos today around a lot of that. Many of us just don't have a taste for organ meats. But, you know, one of the best, smartest things we can do is cultivate a taste for those things, because that's where the real nutrition in meat lies. That's where the nutrient density really is. I mean, liver, in my mind, the ultimate superfood of all time.
Liver? There's
nothing that can come even close to liver. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, liver's pretty amazing. I would agree with you there. I mean, I'm definitely all about nose to tail eating of animals, and anyone that listens to my stuff will know that I'm a strong advocate for that type of eating, and that we should complement those clearly. One of the things I wanted to ask you about with the wolves was, when you saw them hunt, did they just eat the meat? Did they eat the organs? I mean, what you always hear about these animals is that they will eat the organs, but
yeah, I have a funny story to tell about that, because the preferred thing was always the organs, right? They went for that first and foremost. You know, particularly the more dominant animals would go after the heart and the liver and things like that. You know, you hear a lot of vegans talk, and they will say that, oh, the very first thing that carnivores go after is the stomach, because that's where the vegetable matter is and that sort of a thing. So here's a funny story. One of the things we did was we hung on to the stomachs of the animals that we killed and hunted, and we kept them handy. And we would try different types of meats that we would toss out to the wolves and see what they did with it, right? And of course, you know, they were gobbling up regular meat or whatever else they gobbled up like crazy. But when we tossed the stomach out, the normal reaction was that for them to walk up, sniff at it, and sometimes they would turn around and urinate on it. I mean, or they would just walk away. There was an elderly wolf that she was actually the alpha female in the white wolf video, but she was old and arthritic or injured. I don't know if she was arthritic, but she was, you know, clearly limping around and not able to hunt anymore. So she was hungrier. And that was actually her last summer alive, I guess, which was sort of sad. She was a really amazing animal. But and we tossed the stomach out to her, and she sniffed at it and kind of went, and she picked it up and gingerly tore it open with her teeth. And then she grabbed the stomach and she shook her head wildly. And you just saw the plant material flinging everywhere. And then she ate the tripe.
Right. Right. And I've heard of hunter-gatherers doing the same thing. I was talking to a physician who's been with the Hadza in Tanzania, and he said that when they hunt the animals, they'll get the stomach, but then they'll empty it of all the stuff in there. They're not going to eat like digested plant matter, and then they'll eat the stomach. And I think that the stomach can be valuable, but
I think that there were different practices, because I have heard of some primitive tribes, you know, consuming that as well. I mean, okay. But it certainly is not something that we readily sought after, right? No. And now I also probably differ from you in that I do incorporate plant, you know, fibrous vegetables and greens and things like that in the dietary approach I advocate. And I think that there is certainly, you know, ample evidence that there are, I mean, yes, I readily acknowledge the anti-nutrients in many plant-based foods. However, there are also some positive hormetic effects that can be gotten from some of those that are very well documented, and that I think that plants have something to offer us. They also provide us with, and this is again something that is I think that some plant foods have more to offer us today than they ever used to during our long evolutionary journey, from the standpoint of, you know, we have an embattled microbiome today by so many things, by chlorine and fluoride in the water supply and sterilized soils and, you know, and antibiotic use and, you know, overuse of antibiotics, either pharmacologically or through, you know, crappy meat or whatever it is, you know, and lots of people have messed up microbiomes. And the thing that, you know, we have an epidemic now, if you want to call it that. It's not an infectious thing. We don't want to see vaccines against autoimmune. But at any rate, we have what, you know, this this prevalence of autoimmunity now on a global scale that's pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, I agree.
And, right? And it's a big, big, big deal. And one of the things that's going on, and I'm not a big fan of a lot of AIP programs and things like that because they're too generalized. And
autoimmune paleo type programs.
Paleo, right. Yeah. I mean, look, it's possible to just have an immune reactivity. In fact, I have a client like this to just chicken and broccoli, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet that would normally be okay on an AIP program. Mm-hmm. You know, things are just too generalized. But one of the things that is really important in improving what's called oral tolerance, you know, the ability to be able to tolerate a wider variety of foods is through microbial diversity. And one of the best ways of cultivating microbial diversity is through dietary diversity.
I would disagree with you strongly there. There is no evidence that I have seen that dietary diversity has anything to do with microbial diversity.
Well, the
I strongly disagree with that.
Researchers would greatly disagree with you on that.
I disagree with that strongly. There are specific studies that I've cited in the past that plant fiber has no effect, zero effect on alpha diversity. And in studies with carnivore diets, I mean, they've done studies. There's a study at Harvard where they put people on a carnivore diet for a week. There was no change in alpha diversity. And if you look at the hunter-gatherers in Africa, they don't have a diverse diet. They eat like five different foods. They might eat a couple of plant foods.
They aren't subjected to a lot of the same, you know, stresses and pressures that we are in modern civilization either.
Right. I do think diversity is an important thing, but we have to be very careful with measures of diversity because just having a high alpha diversity isn't always the answer because you can have lots of bad bugs. But in general, probably an alpha diversity that's higher is better if you don't have an overgrowth of gram-negative aerobic or
anaerobic. Well, that's just
organisms.
The thing, right? So, right. You know, fiber, those things not everybody tolerates. I don't say everybody has to eat plants.
Right.
But I do think that a variety of plant foods is not a dumb thing in this day and age when our gut biome is under so much assault.
But maybe you can send me that research because I've never seen any convincing research that the diversity of the gut is in any way, shape, or form tied to the diversity of our diet. I've tested my gut diversity on a carnivore diet. I know multiple people who've tested diversity and seen very high diversity on a carnivore diet with limited foods, right? So I think I really rebel against this notion that a diversity of foods equals a diversity in the gut. I think it's a diversity of experience that we should be getting some dirt, you know, we should be out in the sun, we should be in waterways, you know, obviously don't get Giardia swimming in a lake, a river, but I think one of the best ways to increase diversity is to have an animal, to pet a dog, to be in the. I think that we've gotten the diversity thing wrong.
Not all the bacteria that you get from petting a dog are necessarily commensal to our guts, right? It's the endospore forming bacteria that were the probiotics that we were meant to consume. You know,
cultivating a microbiome is something that we don't really know how to do. This, you know,
I'm talking about gut biome, but yes, there's a whole, you know, biosphere or whatever in our body, a microbiosphere that you know involves all of our tissues, and right.
I mean, you know, you look at things like probiotics, and probiotics don't really colonize the gut. They're signals, and so I think that everything we're coming into contact with is going to create signals to our microbiome. But I've not seen very good research to suggest that we have a great grasp of how to get a diverse microbiome, but I think that anthropologically, ancestrally, it's a lot of the behaviors that we do, and certainly eating a junk food diet is not going to be good for that. Eating processed sugars, this is not the way to get a diverse microbiome. But I'm very curious about this notion that we have to eat a variety of foods to get a diverse microbiome, and I haven't seen it borne out in the literature because fiber doesn't increase alpha diversity. Kids on ketogenic diets that are high fat, low fiber, don't have lower alpha diversity. Mm-hmm. And on studies of carnivores, you know, there's no lower alpha diversity. So, I mean, carnivorous humans.
Yeah. I mean, certainly we know that there's fermentable fiber in animal source foods, and some of that fermentable fiber is richer. I mean, it is more prebiotic than even FOS. You know,
that's sure.
The common supplemental prebiotic. And so, you know, I certainly include animal source foods as part of that diversity. And I think eating a diverse range of animal source foods, but, you know, diverse plant foods also provides a diversity of additional nutrients. And, you know, some of those nutrients are going to have hormetic effects that I think are beneficial to us today in a way that are good and reasonable to take advantage of. And of course, herbs have always been, or, you know, we have, you know, herbs have always been used as sort of medicinal substances and things like that. And so we have a longstanding history of a relationship with plants that I don't think I'm inclined to throw out the window. And I also recognize the fact that not everybody can tolerate their, you know, SIBO, you know, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is a very real issue for a lot of people today. And a lot of folks just can't tolerate fiber or certain types of fiber. It will vary from person to person with SIBO in terms of what they can tolerate. But certainly we know that, you know, fiber in the gut of, you know, that bacteria can work on, you know, is an impetus for the production of butyric acid and you know, which again is incredibly important. And butyric acid also in and of itself is an impetus for microbial diversity. You know?
And yeah, sort of as you pointed out, however, people get, I always kind of point this out as a counterpoint that we can use other short chain fatty acids like isobutyrate just as easily as we can use butyrate for the colonic epithelial cells. So I don't think that we need to be hyper-focused on butyrate coming from plant fiber. We can get isobutyrate from protein, and that's just as easily going to trigger all the receptors that butyrate will trigger in the gut, and it can be used as colonic epithelial cell fuel in the same way in the gut. So it can acetate.
Do you have a study you could send me on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I would love to take a look at that.
There's a couple of studies I'll send you. So isobutyrate and butyrate trigger the same receptors in the gut, and isobutyrate has actually been shown to trigger them more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so there's clear evidence for that. And then if we think about it from a fat-based perspective, from like a ketogenic perspective, we can get beta-hydroxybutyrate from the bloodstream. You know, this is a really interesting nuance that in people with overgrowth of hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria or in people who have gut dysfunction, they probably can't even oxidize butyrate in the gut to get it across the membrane of the colonic epithelial cell. People who have gut dysfunction or gut inflammation may actually not be able to use short chain fatty acids as well from the gut, and they may need to use butyrate from the bloodstream. And the only way to do that is if you have ketones in your blood. Mm-hmm. And so when we have ketones in the blood, we don't even need short chain fatty acids from the gut to fuel a colonic epithelial cell. We can just get beta-hydroxybutyrate. And if you look at the pathway, even whether it's butyrate or isobutyrate coming into the colonic epithelial cell, that's going to be transformed into beta-hydroxybutyrate before it's used for fuel in those cells and, you know, becomes acetyl-CoA in the TCA cycle. So,
right. Yeah, and that's the other aspect, because obviously I was the first person in the ancestral health space to actually promote a high fat, you know, lower protein, whatever ketogenic dietary approach. And, you know, I haven't deviated from that core message. I think ketones were actually meant to be our primary metabolic fuel, not glucose. It makes to me all the sense in the world. It makes no sense to me that our ancestors would have relied on glucose as a primary source of fuel. I don't think we'd be here if that were the case. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, protein moderation allows for a much stronger ketogenic metabolism. You know, and higher protein makes for generally a weaker, you know, and less reliable ketogenic metabolism. And so, you know, and also when we consume protein in excess of what we require for our maintenance and repair, you know, there's a certain percentage of that, anywhere from 36% to 58%, depending on whose research you look at, is getting converted to sugar and getting used the same way, has its, you know, glycating effects, et cetera. And, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, doing anything extra for us. You know, we're adding to, you know, toxic metabolites our body has to, you know, has to work to get rid of. We're adding to, you know, urea, we're adding to all kinds of things. And ammonia and, you know, all that sort of a thing. You know, in my mind, I don't really want to exceed, you know, those thresholds on a regular basis. I just don't.
Yeah. Right. I think that we agree about that. I just think that I probably set the bar for protein a little higher. I generally recommend, well, I mean, it's significantly higher. It's not extremely high, you know, but I've kind of thought that 0.8, 0.9 grams per pound is probably what I'd want to see. And, you know, I just don't think that, I think you'd actually have to look at net nitrogen utilization and, you know, look at that kind of stuff to determine, like, does your body need this protein or are you wasting it? Until we have objective evidence, because, you know, otherwise it's just conjecture to say, I don't think we can actually just pick a number out of the air. I think we'd actually have to do studies with a person and say, you know, is this amount of protein adequate for your body? At what point do you start wasting the protein? All right, now your body's gotten enough. And there's going to be differential demands based on macronutrient breakdowns. Obviously, if you're in ketosis.
Your degree of activity and whatever else. But again, what I go back to the idea that infants, the intake of protein from mother's milk has been determined to be about a gram per kilogram, you know, and that's during the time period in a human being's life where rapid cell division is absolutely, and rapid growth is absolutely the most strongly required of any other time period in our lives. I mean, right. That's arguable.
Yeah.
And so why in God's name would an adult who, you know, who isn't needing to grow anymore, may not be procreating anymore, why on earth would we need to even be consuming that much protein, much less protein in excess of that?
I think we also have to remember, it's quite complex. I don't know that I would go so far as to use that as a proxy for adults. I mean, this physiology is quite different and the body can, you know, the body...
We don't need much cell growth.
Well, but the body can make some amino acids, right? There's some essential and some that we can just make. So you don't really know.
We're pretty good at recycling protein in the body. So our requirements, you know, for new protein intake is not going to be, you know, that high, quite frankly. And I don't know why anybody would want to exceed what's adequate. I mean, and it's a great way too of just, you know, I mean, it's expensive for starters, but just from the standpoint of health, in my mind, I've not seen evidence that more is necessarily better. And I worry about if somebody's doing better on higher protein, other than them being perhaps an elite athlete or somebody that, you know, maybe they're trying to repair a broken bone or something where they need to make new cells. Although maintenance and repair, I don't know necessarily that more protein is going to be better, but I just don't, you know, I worry more about a person's digestive health in that regard. If they're eating more protein, if they feel that eating more protein is better, you know, and they're eating a lot of protein to try to feel better, I worry more about the quality of their digestion. And in fact, you know, in my practice, I've generally seen evidence of either malabsorption or digestive issues in people that feel the need to eat more protein in order to feel better.
Hmm. The other thing I wonder about with the fat to protein ratio, I mean, we kind of touched on this earlier, is that there are unique nutrients in fat and protein. And so I think, you know, though we're thinking, when we say protein, a lot of people might think of muscle meat. I'm thinking of both muscle meat and organ meat as protein.
Sure. Yes.
And I think it's important that if we get too little protein, we won't get the nutrients that come with the protein. And so when I've looked at, you know, how much zinc do we need? How much copper do we need? How much selenium do we need? How much riboflavin do we need? How much folate? How much biotin? I'm not convinced that at 0.7 or 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is pretty, in my opinion, pretty low, I'm going to be able to get enough of those nutrients. I'm going to get a lot of fat. That's almost like a traditional ketogenic diet. That's almost going to be like 90% fat and 10% protein by calories. I mean, you think I'm 170 pounds, right? So if you do, you know, you split that in half or even a little more than half, I'm maybe what, 75 kilograms. And then if you take 0.7 of that, I'm only supposed to, by that metric, I would only be eating 50 or 60 grams of protein a day. That's quite a small amount of muscle meat and organs for me as a 170-pound male. 70 grams of protein would be less than a pound of meat per day. That wouldn't even be 10. That would be like 10 ounces of meat total for me in a day. And some of that's going to be organ meat. So it would be like 7 ounces of muscle meat and a few ounces of organ meat, I'm not convinced that in that amount of meat, I'm going to get enough of the nutrients that I need. It seems to work out much better when I expand it to about twice that amount. I'm not talking about 300 grams of protein a day, but I'm talking about 150 grams of protein a day for somebody like me, because as I'm getting 150 grams of protein at 0.8 or 0.9 grams per pound of body weight, then I'm getting, you know, then I'm going to eat 3 ounces of liver and kidney, and I'm going to eat about, you know, a pound plus a pound and a half of steak, sometimes even, you know, a little more than a pound and a half of steak. And that, and if you look at the nutritional content for the micronutrients, then I'm getting to the probably what I would expect to be the micronutrient adequacy. I think if we go too high on fat, we're going to miss out on all the micronutrients that are unique to protein.
Yeah. To me, the mTOR thing is, I think in this day and age is much more important than it probably ever used to be. And it's something that we really do need to be factoring in a lot more. And so, in terms of the nutrient content, obviously, you know, organ meats and things like liver and whatever else are going to provide us with way more nutrient density than, say, muscle meat would. And there are a lot of nutrients that you're just not, you know, I mean, we have to eat, again, a variety of animal source tissues and not just muscle meat. But most people, you know, their idea of meat is muscle meat. You know, their idea of nutrition is that. And, you know, it's you know, you might not get enough if that's all you're eating is muscle meat.
Right. And I think muscle meat has a role. I just think that
muscle meat
has a unique set of nutrients. Organs have a unique set of nutrients. And if people don't want to eat the organ meats, there are all of these companies which make it a little more,
it's
a little more feasible.
But yeah.
So when you were in Resolute Bay, I thought this was another thing that I just wanted to touch on before we wrap up. Like you were essentially living with Inuit who were doing, you said, 80% sustenance eating. Like, were they decrepit? You said the children were happy, right?
They were, you know, the people that I saw, and I wasn't there for a long period of time. I just sort of made general observations over a very short period of a day or two.
So,
I wasn't like watching people go out and hunt and whatever else. It's just that I learned what I learned while I was there with the people that were hosting me there and asking a bunch of questions and whatever have you, that there was quite a lot of subsistence, procurement of, you know, of food. And a lot of that was out of the water and also from the land. And of course it was permafrost, stuff wasn't growing, so they weren't eating it. But they weren't eating, you know, plant foods much at all. And I saw generally people, I didn't see, and you know, it was, that community was also a dry community. In other words, they weren't allowing alcohol into that community, which was probably a good thing. And so people were generally seemed pretty healthy to me. I wasn't seeing a bunch of obesity. You know, I saw, you know, active, bright-eyed, you know, kids and, you know, adults that looked, you know, fairly healthy to me.
Kids that were probably low carb.
Yeah, I'm sure they were extremely low carb. Yeah.
Low carb kids. Yeah. And so they, so that speaks to, I mean, again, it's not a controlled experiment, but it begins to speak to the fertility of the people, you know, and that sort of a lifestyle and the ability to, you know, carry and raise a child, maybe without a lot of carbohydrates. I mean, people think about this a lot as like, oh, kids need carbs, but who knows? I think we're still learning. So, well, where can people find more of your work if they want to look at your stuff?
Right. So I've got my books, obviously Primal Body, Primal Mind, and also Primal Fat Burner being the more recent book. And there's also an ebook I have called Rethinking Fatigue, which is all about kind of the myth, I guess, is what I call it, of adrenal fatigue, adrenal burnout. It's understanding what your adrenals are really telling you and what you can do about it. And my primary blog and website is primalbody-primalmind.com. And I also have I teach an online certification course that it's like 52 weeks worth of material called Primal Restoration.
Awesome.
And you can go to primalcourses.com to learn more about that. I'm also about to release a program called the Primalgenic Plan. It's a 3-week meal by meal total health transformation program, which is all about adopting, you know, you know, what I now call a primalgenic way of eating. I'm kind of divesting myself a little bit from kind of the traditional notions of paleo and keto, which in my view have become a little excessively commercialized and have begun to mean something different to everybody claiming to practice them. And so I'm trying to take control of my own definitions, you know, by using that term. But it's all really about health optimization. And so you can go to primalgenic.com and put in your name, you know, your email, whatever, which I will never abuse. And then you will be among the first to be notified when that program becomes available. And it's the program that I have been most asked to create out of everything. So I'll be excited to release that in about the next month or so.
Great. So the last question I always ask everyone is, what is the most radical thing that you have done and recently? This is radical, like 80s radical.
80s radical.
Well, I mean, like, just that's the spirit of the word radical.
Radical. Man. I wish you'd asked me before so I'd have had some time to think about it. I don't know, you know, I've been putting some time into studying primitive skills. I don't know how radical that is.
That's pretty radical. What kind of skills?
This has been something I've been interested in my entire life, you know, so everything from fire building to cordage to, you know, that kind of, you know, thing, all of the, you know, I've done my share of, you know, foraging classes, which are really, really interesting and telling in terms of what our ancestors might have done. And I don't know, there's some of that. I've also done a lot of study and inquiry into, you know, the use of, you know, shall we say, visionary plant medicines. And that's an area of tremendous interest to me, too. That may have influenced our evolutionary development in other ways, but that goes slightly beyond the whole dietary thing. So
yeah, some fascinating concepts. Yeah, I really like the survival stuff and the foraging stuff as well, and the hunting stuff, I guess, primarily. So that's cool. That's definitely radical. Well, thank you so much for coming on and having this discussion. I really enjoyed it. I think that one of the things that I strive for and that I want to continue to do in the podcast is not to make it an echo chamber. And so I really appreciate the discourse and. I think differences in opinions are healthy and it's good for people to see different sides, and that's how we all learn and grow. And so I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your ideas, and I'm so excited to continue collaborating, and I'm definitely going to send you studies about isobutyrate.
Excellent. I look forward to that, Paul.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I look forward to staying in touch.
All right, you guys, thank you for listening to that podcast. Hope you enjoyed that friendly debate. I thought it was so cool to hear about what the wolves did and what Nora observed with these animals, and also the Inuit and all that she saw in the Arctic and her perspective on Paleolithic diet. I think we definitely agree, Nora and I do, about meat and organs. That's a huge part of all this and a really big piece of this whole equation. And I think we need a little more protein than Nora does. I do think the fat is important, but if you don't get enough protein, you won't build muscle, et cetera, et cetera. Totally respect your opinion. Thank you to her for coming on the show. Really had a good time with this one. Please check out my sponsors, heartandsoil.co. You guys know this is my jam. I talk about it all the time. Join us for Nose to Tail November. Hashtag Nose to Tail November. Get some organs, either fresh or our desiccated organs. We're working so hard to get everything back in stock. Always check in with us. You can always email me, drpaul@heartandsoil.co. That's .co with product questions or questions about how to construct a Nose to Tail carnivore diet. Happy to help you with that. Spend a lot of time answering emails these days, and I like it because I like to hear the feedback. I like to hear what works for you guys and what doesn't. Check out whiteoakpastures.com, belcampo.com, chilitechnology.com. CarnivoreMD is the code for all those. ChiliPad, Uller, cindergrill.com, and blueblocks.com, blublox.com. Thank you to all my sponsors. This podcast would not be possible without them. And you know what? It means that I get to sleep on a chili pad, which is freaking amazing, and Uller. It's amazing sleep. It means that I get to eat meat from White Oak Pastures in Belcampo, which makes me happy. It means that I get to wear glasses from Blue Blocks, so my eyes are protected from blue light. And it means that I get to cook my food on a cinder grill. So I'm stoked because I get hooked up when these are my sponsors too. You guys are going to love them. I would never have anybody on the show that I didn't think was a good thing. And believe me, a lot of people come at me for sponsorship. Like these greens companies, I'm like, hell no, you ain't coming on my show. You guys should not be eating greens. I don't want people to eat greens unless it's April Fool's. So anyway, don't be a fool. Don't eat greens. I'm just kidding. You guys aren't fools if you eat greens. Check us out at heartandsoil.co. Get Nose to Tail Nutrition somehow. Sign up for our newsletter at heartandsoil.co. If you guys follow me on Instagram, you know that I went hunting this weekend and I shot a deer respectfully with my bow. There's a picture of me with a heart. I think it caused some squeamish people to unfollow me, but that's okay because they'll be back. And I know that all you guys who are part of the remembering understand that this is actually how we're supposed to be living as humans. And we shouldn't be squeamish with regard to this. We should do it respectfully. And my goodness, I respect that deer every time I eat it in a way that is different than food that I just get from the grocery store that I'm not connected with. So it was really nice to be able to go out and do that. I got to go with my team to Enchanted Rock on Friday night. That place is amazing in Texas, but you don't want to go there because it shouldn't. I don't want it to get overcrowded. But if you're in Texas, you should check out Enchanted Rock. Cool. There's a cave on top. We looked at the stars. It's just so cool to share all of this with my tribe at Heart and Soil. So until next week, you guys, stay radical. You are all a part of the remembering. Thank you for joining us for Nose to Tail November at heartandsoil.co. Look for a controversial thoughts video this Friday on a couple of things. I'll leave it as a surprise what it's actually going to be about, but those come out on Fridays everywhere. And there should be a lot of exciting things from Heart and Soil coming down the pipe. So, all right. Love you guys. Social media is the pandemic. Wilderness is the answer. Get in the wilderness. You are part of the remembering. Stay radical. I got all the taglines. See ya.